David Brooke ran into a tug, broke in half, and sank. Professor Bourne, as a good Oxford man, takes no credit for that, but tonight they will be having a dinner in the absence of a race, which is, I understand, to be run tomorrow. Let me make the usual pitch for memberships. As you know, the Institute is very much dependent for its ability to finance the programs on membership receipts. Charles offered last week a bonus, which I'll continue to offer on his behalf this week and behalf of the Institute. If you join the Institute tonight, you will get the benefit of membership next year on the basis that the memberships cost $2 for students, $10 single, and $15 for family. That's a very good bargain, which I recommend to you. Now, on your behalf and that of Cecil H. and Ida Green Visiting Professorships, I welcome Dr. and Mrs. Block to Vancouver, to the University of British Columbia, and to the Vancouver Institute. Most of you will know that our speaker tonight, Dr. Conrad Emil Block, a cheerful, open, and if I may say, fit biochemist, on the nomination of the Carolin Institute, which is the Faculty of Medicine in Stockholm, was awarded in 1964 the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine. Some of you will know that that recognition afforded by this honor came after 25 continuous works in his labs at Columbia, the University of Chicago, and Harvard. He successfully, stage by stage, disentangled and articulated for the first time the mechanics of the 35 consecutive stages needed to describe the process that the body follows in making a fatty substance called cholesterol from acetic acid. These findings are an important step in understanding vascular diseases. And as a preface to this evening's talk, I'll try in a few moments to give you an insight into the man behind this wondrous academic accomplishment. You will remember that it's sometimes difficult to see behind a person whose fame is established, but Dr. Block began life in 1912 in Nessa, a small town in the province of Silesia, then one of the easterly province of Kaiser's Germany, and now in Poland. He was one of three children in the family of, I'm glad to report, a small town country lawyer. He thinks now that his father was an advocate. While both his parents are now gone, the parents, his brother and sister, later followed him to the United States. More of this in a moment. He began with his brother and sister his elementary schooling in Nessa from 1918 until 1930, and by the 1930s, say 18, he early developed an interest in organic chemistry, but in the absence of pure science courses in the Germany of that day, he attended the Technische Hochschule in Munich, Bavaria, completing in the spring of 1934 the degree of a chemical engineer. From that institute in Munich, he took two letters of recommendation, which will be the focus of my preface, one from the director of the Munich Institute and another from a very distinguished chemist, and he sent those letters to a small clinic in Davos, Switzerland. Davos, we know, as a ski resort. He went as a staff chemist in a small staff, and this was, in many ways, the turning point of his career for two reasons. It enabled him to publish papers, and it led to his emigration to the United States. Apart from a free pass on the ski lift, he had access to a research library. In the course of doing a review, he came across the name of Rudolf Anderson, a man he now describes as a crusty Norwegian, who was then at Yale. Anderson had done a lot of work in Dr. Block's field. Block wrote to him. Anderson wrote back, sending papers and some advice on how to conduct himself in his work. At one point, Dr. Block sent to him some results which conflicted with Professor Anderson's results. It later turned out that while Dr. Block was prepared to defer to Anderson, Dr. Block was right. That established a connection. He then, coming to the end of his permitted stay in Switzerland, sent off these two letters of recommendation that he had from Munich. One was a very long letter. The other was extremely short. It said simply, "Mr. Block is good." Having sent this letter to Anderson at Yale, he got back two further letters, and in the nick of time, as his residency permit was about to expire, the first read, they were both from the Dean of Medicine at Yale, then Dean Winternitz, to whom it may concern. This will confirm that Mr. Conrad Block has been appointed a research assistant in biochemistry at Yale Medical School, effective 1 September 1936, yours truly, Winter Nitz, Dean of Medicine, Yale University. The second letter read, Dear Block, this letter is meant to help you to emigrate. Unfortunately, Yale has no funds to employ you, yours truly. I wonder if we'd have the courage to do that today. On his arrival in New Haven, as there was no place for him, he sought advice. We would today call it counseling on career paths. He was advised to go to Columbia to do some pre-doctoral work. He had then developed a deep interest in biological chemistry. He showed the Fisher letter, that's the Mr. Block is good one, to Professor H. Thatcher Clark, then the head of the biochemistry department. Professor Clark was an enthusiastic amateur physician and the leader of a small chamber orchestra. On the basis of the Fisher letter and a 15-minute interview, the last question of which was from Professor Clark, by the way, do you play an instrument? To which Mr. Block answered, yes, I used to play the cello, and I hope to find the opportunity to play it again. Professor H. Thatcher Clark found a postdoctoral student and a predoctoral student and a member of his orchestra. Mr. Block earned his PhD in the spring of 1938. In those days, as some of you will remember, the predoctoral fellows worked as lab assistants all day, and they did their academic work at the end of the day and into the early morning. After his PhD, he became a postdoctoral fellow in the lab of Professor Rudolf Schoenheimer at Columbia. Now, Professor Schoenheimer was one of the first to use isotopes to trace biochemical elements in the body. Thus, Block was at a very early stage of his career in on the first stage of the work which developed isotopic traces. He calls this age now the Golden Age of Science. And it was in 1942 at Columbia that Dr. Block and a colleague discovered the two-carbon compound, acetic acid, was the major building block in the more than 30 steps involved in the natural body formulation of cholesterol. The work at Columbia continued from 1939 until he received his first academic appointment in 1946 at Chicago. He was first an assistant, soon associate, and full professor. We were talking about his talk tonight, and he said in the course of his work he's taken an interest in the beginning of life, how it happened 2 to 3 billion years ago, say 1 to 2 billion years after the Earth was first formed. And I was wondering aloud to Dr. Block how I could help you quantify that those time periods. He said quickly, why, it's less than 1% of the U.S. budgetary deficit. So I leave that with you. The final story, which I'm going to give to you, I asked him how it was that he came to the cholesterol molecule as a field. He explained that in the course of it, gave me this story, which I give you. His supervisor, Dr. Schoenheimer, died very suddenly. He had three assistants, Dr. Block and two others. They were roughly contemporary. The prior work of the group broke down into three easily dividable areas. The financing of the continuation of the work was assured. The discussions how to divide the work between the three survivors did not result in an agreement. One of the fields happened to be cholesterol. In the absence of being able to make a rational choice, they finally tossed coins and Dr. Block got cholesterol. So the work began at Chicago, at Columbia perhaps, worked on at Chicago and finished at Harvard, brought the Nobel Prize in 1967. It's not possible to say that Dr. Fisher's letter, Mr. Block is good, was a successful coin toss brought our speaker to us tonight, but it does bring some insight into the man. Two children, one son, married, two children, an economist, and a daughter, a nurse practitioner, a passel of honorary degrees, a lab, where he still works with 4 to 5 assistants. He says of himself, the university has kindly let the old timer stay on. I continue to get paid for having fun. May I, on behalf of the Institute and the Cecil H. and Ida Green Visiting Professorships, welcome Dr. Block.
Mr. Vogel, members and friends of the Vancouver Institute. For a while, Mr. Vogel, I was afraid you were going to give my paper, but you had assured me that you would not speak for more than 2 or 3 minutes, and you kept your word. It is both an honor but also a challenge to address the members of your institute. In fact, I've accepted your invitation with some trepidation. As public speakers, chemists are handicapped, perhaps more than any other scientists. Their language, a language of atoms, molecules, and bonds, is a shorthand that is not easy to comprehend without prior exposure. And I would at this point warn you that I will have to use some chemical formula, and there is still time to leave. The second source of my apprehension is a matter of legitimacy. My speaking on evolution without the proper credentials, as it were. But this second source of concern is not an important one to me. Many scientists, licensed or not, speculate about evolution, and they do so with impunity. There is no risk involved because inherently evolutionary theories, hypotheses, postulates cannot be proven right or wrong. We cannot recreate the origin of the universe, the origin of life, and the descent of man, and therefore unable to provide the rigid criteria, the experimental evidence scientists would require or accept as essential proof in their own fields. Nevertheless, evolution in all its aspects, from the Big Bang to man, is a legitimate subject for serious scientific thought and pursuit. It challenges the intellect and provides a common focus and perspective for the entire range of scientific contemporary endeavor. For astronomers, physicists, chemists, biologists, geneticists, paleontologists, and even linguists. This, of course, is Darwin's great gift to humanity. Now, Charles Darwin's famous paper on the origin of species, read by the geologist Lyell before the Linnean Society in London in 1858, has truly revolutionized scientific thought. Its wide impact was felt almost at once during the late 19th century, as witnessed by the enthusiastic comment of Ludwig Boltzmann, the founder of statistical physics, to quote, "If we ask whether we shall call this the 19th century, the century of iron, steam, or electricity, then I can answer with complete conviction it will surely be called the century of the mechanistic understanding of nature, the century of Darwin." It is fair to say that a similar statement today would be even more emphatic, tempered perhaps by the realization that the full mechanistic understanding for nature is still a distant goal. Let me make it quite clear, evolution itself, which means a process of change, is a fact, at least in the minds of all serious scholars who have spent their lives studying the subject. If we nevertheless speak of evolutionary theory, we pay heed to the fact that the detailed mechanism, the processes of Darwinian evolution, the descent of species by natural selection, is still in the realm of speculation and controversy. I want to make it quite clear at the outset that my remarks as well should be taken for what they are, conclusions and judgments based on deduction and inference. They're neither scientific faction nor rigidly proven fact. Before I come to chemistry and evolution, I must provide some background. When we speak of the Age of Enlightenment, we refer to man's endeavor to replace faith or myth by scientifically reasoned theory. As the term implies, evolution is a historical process evolving in time, not compatible with simultaneous creation. This realization began long before Darwin. In 1669 already, it occurred to the Danish anatomist Nicolaus Steno that the fossilized teeth of sharks, he observed, could not possibly enter an object as solid as sedimentary rock. Was it not more likely, as Steno speculated, that loose sedimentary deposits first accumulate around the ancient teeth and subsequently harden into rock? Hence the notion that the Earth's surface had a history and was mirrored by the fossil record. Steiner's observation was to shake the faith in the literal interpretation of Genesis or divine creation and of Noah's Ark. Was the earth indeed only a few thousand years old, as the Bible tells us? Could one accept Archbishop Usher's calculation that the earth was created in 4004 BC on May 29th at 9:30 a.m.? Estimates of the age of the earth through the centuries are by themselves a fascinating chapter of evolution, and I will mention just a few of the more remarkable ones. The Comte de Buffon in the 1750s was the first to approach the subject experimentally, if rather crudely, realizing that the rate of cooling of a solid body is a function of its mass. He prepared cast iron globes of various sizes, heated them to red heat, and then measured the time it took for the various globes to cool to a temperature cool enough to the touch of his hand. Not a very accurate method. With this set of values, he could extrapolate the rate of cooling to that of a solid body the size of the Earth. And the number he arrived at was some 75,000 years. His contemporary, Sir Isaac Newton, had come up with a very similar figure, namely a 50,000 years, and Kant, in his cosmology, raised it to millions. But it attests to Darwin's genius and insight that he was the first to place the age of the Earth in the range of billions of years. Yet his estimate was not left unchallenged. Lord Kelvin, the famous 19th century physicist, disputed Darwin's estimate. His calculations, based on the temperature gradient at various depths of the Earth, led him to a figure of a mere 24 million years. Alas, he was unaware of the heat-producing decay of radioactive elements, not known at Kelvin's time. As Ernst Mayr, one of the major figures in contemporary evolutionary theory, comments, since biology was an inferior science, inferior to physics, there was no doubt in Kelvin's mind that the biological evidence was wrong. Today we estimate the age of the Earth to be about 5 billion years, judging from radioactive decay measurements, an estimate that I believe has not been further inflated or will be further inflated in the future. Oh, this one. This is my, I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. I think it's this one, yes. Yes. Now, evolution means a chronological process at all material levels, progressing from the, as you will see in this slide, from the level of atoms at the top there, from lighter atoms.
Is this the normal? Push it up.
Oh, yes, it is, yes. From the lightest atom, hydrogen, to elements which are here designated as organogenic elements, because these are the elements, hydrogen, carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, sulfur, and phosphorus, which we find in living matter. This is followed by the formation of organogenic molecules, the combination of these atoms, such as methane, carbon monoxide, carbon dioxide, water, and ammonia. Since it is assumed that the Earth is roughly 5 billion years old, as I told you, we have a large gap of events, of dating events, between the origin of the Earth and the appearance of the first biological molecules. Now, we distinguish after, in the period after the elements were formed, the period in which these elements, these molecules combine to small biological molecules such as sugar, amino acids, the constituents of proteins, and purines and pyrimidines, the constituents of nucleic acid. These smaller molecules then combined to biochemical macromolecules, RNA, proteins, the well-known DNA, and then we find the first evidence of life in the form of a fossil record roughly 3.5 billion years after, ago. And it is this point that Darwinian evolution begins. But there were evolutionary steps at the pre-Darwinian level which involved the formation and selection of molecules which made up the substance of life. And later on, and these first fossils, which the impression of these fossils resembled those of contemporary algae, persisted for a long time, a form of life which we call anaerobic, that is, life without oxygen. And the next major event in evolution was the production of oxygen by photolysis of water to form molecular oxygen. And this led to what is referred to as a Cambrian explosion, and followed by diversification, sexual reproduction, ultimately to mammals and man. This is just to give you an idea of the time scale and to identify the period in the origin of life, which I am personally interested in, which is pre-Darwinian, namely at this stage here when small biomolecules were formed. Now, modern science, based on observation and quantitative measurements, begins with astronomy, the description of the motion of planets, followed by Newton's laws of gravitation. Thereafter, around 1800, we enter the age of chemistry. Individual chemical elements began to be recognized and organic compounds isolated from living matter. Biology is a relative latecomer in this chronology. Only in modern times has biology turned from pure linear description and classification of organisms to the examination of mechanistic processes. Today, biology dominates the scene and provides us with ever more detailed molecular analysis of biological events, including heredity. This temporal evolution of the insights of the natural sciences can be said to recapitulate or parallel the evolution of the universe from macrocosm to microcosm. It is intriguing that the evolutionary sequence of the operating forces, physical, chemical, and biological, corresponds to Auguste Comte's hierarchy or rank order of the natural sciences, which is shown here in the second slide, beginning with mathematics and ending with a modern branch of biology, going from old to new, going from strict relationships expressed in the form of laws and astronomy and physics, to chemistry, which has only rules but no laws, and rules allow for exceptions, and finally to biology, which has not even rules, but only dogmas and hypotheses. And I don't quite know how to describe the generalizations in the newest of the sciences. Let me now come to chemistry, the science that constitutes the link between physics and biology, between atoms and organized living systems. How can chemistry contribute, either speculatively or experimentally, to evolutionary theory? The answer is that it can, and it has done so in two ways. Experimentally, a few chemists are attempting to reproduce by test tube experiment the organic molecules, the raw materials necessary for life to get underway, the events presumed to have, and let me underline, presumed to have happened during the molecular and prebiotic phase. The second, more speculative endeavor, and in fact the main thrust of my discussion to come later, is to unravel what I would like to call the logic of chemistry of life, to rationalize the structure of organic molecules in terms of their biological function. A word first about the test tube experiments. These test tube experiments, which we will talk about in a moment, were inspired by a very famous hypothesis formulated in the 1920s by the Russian biologist Oparin and the English biologist Haldane. Their postulates included the statement that the major structural types which you find in cells today, nucleic acids and so forth, they're created chemically, that is, before life began. Today we take this for granted. Secondly, and this is very crucial from my point of view, the primitive prebiotic atmosphere, the atmosphere before life began, contained hydrogen, methane, ammonia, and water, but no oxygen. It was, as we call it, anaerobic. Thirdly, from these inorganic components, organic compounds were formed by some source of energy which may have been heat, ultraviolet, or light, or electric discharges, which one we do not know. Then the accumulating organic compounds, commonly referred to as the primordial soup, probably the consistency of chicken soup, gave rise to the first anaerobic cells, and so forth. The fifth postulate is not important. Now, why this second postulate is so important derives from the following consideration. It was actually essential that oxygen be absent when the first organic molecules were formed, because organic molecules are very sensitive to oxygen and would have been burned had oxygen been present at these early stages. In the presence of oxygen, organic molecules would predictably have been unstable and would have perished and been spoiled. The original experiments which were designed to test this hypothesis were carried out with the inspiration of Professor Harold Dury, then at the University of San Diego, by Dr. Stanley Miller. Now, and they led to a truly witch's brew of small molecules. Now, these experiments were fashioned to conform with the Oparin-Holden hypothesis. In other words, they were carried out with a gas phase consisting of methane, ammonia, carbon monoxide, water, and hydrogen. And then they were enclosed in a vessel which contained some water, and then exposed to some electric discharge, a generator of electric charge. And then the contents after 24 hours of the flask were analyzed and showed an astonishing variety of compounds formed from these ingredients. They included, for example, HCN, hydrogen cyanide, or prussic acid, which, as you know, is a very poisonous substance. And then they included formaldehyde, which is a very reactive molecule and in turn can give rise to sugars and fatty acids. But most excitingly, Miller-Urey experiment led to the identification of amino acids, the building stones of proteins, and purines and pyrimidines, which are the subunits or building stones of nucleic acid, along with phosphate and sugars formed presumably from acetaldehyde. So representatives of the compound shown above the dotted line here have been analyzed and have been formed in the test tube under these presumed primitive Earth conditions. And since we find this kind of compounds today in living cell, this type of experimentation provides an attractive model, but no means proof, for what might have been the prebiotic chemical phase that set the stage for life to evolve. Let me stress again the importance of the absence of oxygen during chemical evolution in the following context. It is a remarkable fact, not always noted, that the analogous chemistry all contemporary cells perform for making the molecules essential for life, namely proteins, nucleic acids, carbohydrates, and fats, have remained anaerobic throughout the entire evolutionary process. That is, the mechanism adopted at the beginning, when life, beginning of life, have not been changed. And this by itself is a very powerful argument in favor of Darwinian theory. It is tantamount to saying that life, albeit only in its most primitive microbial form, is possible in the total absence of oxygen. The air we breathe is not needed for primitive forms of life. And it was a great French scientist, Louis Pasteur, who was the first to demonstrate this phenomenon, which he called la vie sans air. And he discovered it in the course of his famous study on the brewing process, the yeast fermentation of starch to alcohol. And as an aside of historical interest and a comment on goals and motivations by scientists, not all scientists to be sure, let me quote from Pasteur's Etude sur la bière. Quote, I undertook studies of brewer's yeast directly after the conclusion of the Franco-Prussian War in 1871 and continued them relentlessly ever since, with the resolution of carrying them far enough to stamp this lasting progress in an industry in which Germany is now superior to us. End of quote. Whether Pasteur succeeded is a matter of personal taste. At any rate, Pasteur's experiments with yeast and the existence to this day of bacteria which thrive in the complete absence of oxygen and are in fact poisoned by air tells us that all the molecules essential for life, proteins, nucleic acids, and so on, could have been generated before life began in the absence of oxygen. And by the same token, and I cannot make the point too strongly, that the appearance of oxygen, perhaps 2 million years or so ago, a few billion years after life began, was a momentous event for evolution, as momentous as the origin of life itself. Without it, evolution would have come to a halt at the level of primitive microbial forms of the kind I've just mentioned. Now, it is often said that the basic ground plan for metabolism, that is, biochemical transformations, has remained essentially unchanged from the most primitive cells to man. And this is certainly true, as I have pointed out, for what we may call the minimal processes of life, how proteins, nucleic acids, fats, and starch are made. And perhaps most convincingly, the permanence of the universal three-letter genetic code. And this unity and this sharing of biochemical machinery is indeed, as I said a moment ago, a very powerful argument for Darwin's common descent of all forms of life. Yet the enormous diversity of species which we see around us, or of which we see only an estimated 0.1% of all the species that have ever existed, tells us that superimposed on these minimal processes, there are biochemical inventions or innovations that have occurred late in an evolution. In my view, there are more than relatively minor modifications. I mentioned photosynthesis, the ability of primitive algae to break down water and thereby release oxygen with the aid of sunlight is one such event. And it caused a veritable revolution and must have speeded up evolution enormously. Let me list some of these processes which we know to depend on the essential presence of oxygen and therefore occurred later during evolution. There were inventions for which the presence of aerobic organisms was essential. Now, first of all, oxygen, once it appeared in the environment, advanced evolution by making the formation or utilization and formation of energy more effective. In fermentation, such as yeast or certain bacteria, you obtain either lactic acid or ethanol. Respiration, which means the complete combustion of the 6 carbon atoms of glucose to carbon dioxide and water, yields roughly 12 times as much energy as the anaerobic mode of life. So this is one principal facet of life in the presence of oxygen. It enormously improves the efficiency of biochemical operations, of energy production, and therefore was of enormous selective advantage. And then many of the vitamins we know, for example, vitamin A and rhodopsin of the visual purple, certain hormones such as thyroxin, then certain components of connective tissue, such as contain proteins which are derived or formed only in the presence of molecular oxygen, and this list of compounds includes cholesterol, about which I will talk later on. So you see from this diversity of compounds here that differentiation, sexual reproduction, in short, all the more evolved forms of life depended on photosynthesis as an essential event in evolution. The question is sometimes asked, is there a chance that on this planet life could start all over again from inanimate matter, today or at any time? The answer is clearly no, and again oxygen is a reason. As we have seen, the success of the Miller-Urey experiments to produce organic molecules depends critically on the total absence of oxygen. Such conditions clearly do not exist today, and even if they did, primitive emerging cells would immediately fall prey to the already existing forms of life. I now turn to a second area of chemical and more personal concern, the relationship of chemical structure to biological function. It is intriguing and indeed striking that the number and variety of chemical structures, or rather structural types, in contemporary forms of life is very limited, probably to a few thousand. Whatever its actual number, this is exceedingly small compared to the vast and probably incalculable multitude of chemically possible combinations between the various elements which I've called biogenic: carbon, nitrogen, hydrogen, oxygen, phosphorus, and sulfur, all of which must have existed in the primordial soup before and at the time when life began. Let me illustrate. A modern handbook of organic chemistry lists over 3 million carbon compounds that have been made by organic chemists, and I'm sure there are still many more to come. Whether an equal or even larger number existed in the primordial soup, of course, cannot be proven. There is no record of this prebiotic past, but it is most reasonable from purely chemical consideration. All we can do is to make certain plausible assumptions about the possible, but not the actual, or the potential, and not the real. My inquiry poses the question, why is it that whatever the forces at work when life began, only certain of the available molecules were chosen, and why were others, probably the vast majority, rejected? The outcome of the Miller-Urey experiments is relevant in this connection. This table lists the few examples of the amino acids, the protein constituents, which Miller identified on, from his primitive experiments under simulated primitive Earth conditions: the amino acid glycine, alanine, valine, and leucine. But, and this is somewhat disturbing, these were not the only amino acids, that is, the amino acids which are found in cell proteins today, which were produced under these conditions. And don't look at the structural details of these amino acids in the column on the right under the heading of rejected. These are amino acids found under the conditions of the Miller experiments, but not found in contemporary cells. What does that mean? If the same experiments give a true picture of what happened before life began, then at the time life began, there must have been a selection process from this huge reservoir of organic compounds. And one can call this, of course, a pre-Darwinian process of natural selection. What is the basis of the rejection and selection? Now, this phenomenon of selection versus rejection, of course, is expressed, is implicit in Darwin's formulation of evolution by natural selection. However, later evolutionists have paraphrased it and have coined it as choices between the potential and the real, or the prospective and the realized, or chance and necessity, perhaps the most famous one, and, as I already mentioned, the actual and the possible. All these paraphrasings may have a slightly different flavor, but their meaning is the same. What I am proposing is that selection operated not only during the evolution of organisms, but already at the pre-Darwinian stage when the first building blocks for ancestral cells were assembled. What we came to be and are is not a matter of chance alone, but of selection determined ultimately by the logic of chemistry. Now, the chemical structures of two universally occurring small biomolecules will illustrate what I have in mind, or what I mean by chemical logic. Now, shown here are the structures of two or three sugar molecules which occur in cells today, glucose, galactose, and mannose. Now, glucose is the most common one and is the universal sugar molecule. It is found in largest concentrations in the cell, and is also the most versatile one. All cells can use glucose. Not all cells can use galactose or mannose. Now, these compounds all have six carbon atoms, and their structures differ very slightly. If you look carefully, you see, for example, this OH group here at position 4 is roughly horizontal to the plane of the molecule in glucose, but it is vertical, or axial, as the chemist calls it, in galactose. And in mannose, another one of these substituents, namely at carbon atom 2, points upwards and not sideways as in glucose. The result is that, the conclusion is that in glucose, uniquely, all the bulky substituents point sideways, as it were, away from each other, or equatorially, as the chemist calls it. And this equatorial orientation, and here you have to take my word for it, stabilizes the molecule because there's a minimum of what are known as non-bonded interactions. Now, there are in fact 16 sugar molecules which have the same overall chemical composition as glucose, but which differ only in the spatial arrangement of these OH groups, as I've indicated in these three instances. And why then, glucose was chosen from amongst its cousins is a matter of spatial arrangement of the substituents. So a rather sophisticated chemical detail which accounts, I like to believe, accounts for the universality of glucose in all forms of life. Now, stability and ease of chemical formation can also be invoked for the selection of the building blocks of the nucleic acids, which are known as purines and pyrimidines. And let us ask, why were only 5 of these molecules chosen and not any of the numerous closely related structures that are conceivable? Now, let us look at one typical and generally occurring constituent of nucleic acids, including DNA. This is a base, or a purine base, adenine, and the total composition is 5 hydrogens, 5 carbons, and 5 nitrogens. And if you break up this structure on paper by enclosing these CHN or AHNC units, you find that the adenine molecule is composed of 5 subunits of HCN, or prussic acid. Now, remember, I made the point that under the prebiotic simulated conditions of the primitive Earth, HCN is a major constituent. And in fact, HCN is also found in outer space. It has been identified spectroscopically in recent years. So HCN is an ideal candidate for forming relatively easily this complex molecule, which is a basic and universal constituent of all nucleic acids. And in fact, there exists a commercial process now for making this molecule simply from HCN. Now, it's therefore reasonable from its ease of formation that, like glucose, adenine was available in large quantity in the primordial brew. Yet abundance, that is, chemical stability per se, is probably only a necessary but not a sufficient condition for selection, at least in this instance. Adenine and all other purine and pyrimidine bases have one distinct chemical feature, which accounts for the double helical structure of DNA and the specific information content of the hereditary material. The secret lies in the so-called hydrogen bond. Now, hydrogen forms bonds with carbon atoms, and these bonds are very strong. It's very difficult to pull the hydrogen away from a carbon atom, for example, in methane. Hydrogen also attaches to nitrogen, and this, however, is a much weaker bond. And, for example, if this nitrogen carrying two hydrogens finds itself in the vicinity of another group which forms weak bonds with hydrogen, and these are the CO bonds, then this hydrogen will tend to be shared between nitrogen and oxygen, one being the donor and the other one the acceptor. So you can shift hydrogen from a nitrogen to oxygen or vice versa. And this occurs spontaneously. You form the so-called hydrogen bond or hydrogen bridges. Now, in order to form these hydrogen bonds, and I've indicated here that carbons carrying oxygen have a tendency to combine with hydrogen from an acceptor, and so are certain hydrogen-deficient nitrogens, whereas nitrogens which already contain hydrogens have a tendency to give off hydrogen to an hydrogen acceptor. It is very important for this hydrogen donation and acceptance that the molecule in question, and I have illustrated this with another nucleic acid base, namely cytosine, that the molecule, that these hydrogens, mobile hydrogens, let's call them, are properly positioned in the molecule. You have more than one nitrogen in this molecule, namely three, and you have one oxygen in this molecule. So potentially, all these atoms can act as hydrogen acceptors or donors. If this were so, we would be in a terrible mess, because the whole specificity of the genetic code would vanish. And nature has so designed these molecules, purines and pyrimidines, that only one form, namely the one which forms the correct hydrogen bonds, predominates. And I've illustrated here four possible forms of this nucleic acid base, namely cytosine. You can shift, for example, the hydrogen from here to the adjacent you can remove a hydrogen from this position here, or you can add a hydrogen to this nitrogen, and so on. In other words, there are mobile hydrogens in this molecule which can attach themselves preferentially to an oxygen or a nitrogen, or one of the various nitrogens. Now, the design of nature is such that only one of these four forms does in fact exist in solution, or predominantly so. If you make a solution, aqueous solution of this molecule, you find that A predominates by far. In fact, the ratio of A to the sum of B plus C plus D is as 100,000 to 1. And it is this preference for one single form, which one can call the confident form, the competent form, the predominance of the so-called keto structure. This is the keto structure in contrast to this structure, which you will call the enol structure, for reasons which you will see in a moment, which assures correct base pairing, that is, the fidelity of the reading frame of the genetic code. The code is read essentially error-free, and the genetic material passed on to offspring intact. And I show here an example of this hydrogen bonding between two constituents in the nucleic acid. You have three atoms here which can engage in hydrogen bonding with their partners, and which does give rise to the typical double helix, which all of you know. And talking about the double helix, let me recount from a chapter of James Watson's widely read Double Helix, where he comments on the frustration that he and Francis Crick experienced during their early and at first unsuccessful attempts to build a model of DNA consistent with all the available facts. When they began this remarkable journey, they chose what proved later to be the wrong or enol forms that chose this formulation of the purine and pyrimidine basis instead of this one. And why did they choose them? Because the textbook said so. Because of ignorance, of insufficient chemical knowledge, this is how the purine bases were formulated in the enol form rather than the keto form. One day, an X-ray crystallographer, Jerry Donahue, walked into Watson and Crick's laboratory and pointed out that the textbook structures were probably wrong. The keto forms corresponded to reality and not the enol form. And this realization broke the logjam and ultimately allowed Watson and Crick, actually in very short order, to propose a double helical DNA which has withstood the test of time. And it's undoubtedly the most important chemical structure so far discovered by man. The key issue here is a very subtle one. The mere shifting of a hydrogen from one position in the molecule to another and makes a difference between right and wrong, a difference which the natural selection process recognized and exploited. The designs and motives of nature or wisdom, whatever you wish to call it, are very sophisticated indeed, that is, chemical sophistication of the highest order. My own more direct interest in chemical aspects of evolution stems from research in the biological formation of cholesterol, as has been mentioned. It has intrigued me for several decades, not because of its notoriety, but because of its complex chemistry. Some time ago, I came to the conclusion that cholesterol, in contrast to sugars, nucleic acids, and proteins, the ubiquitous and essential minimal molecules for life must have arisen late in evolution. And here you have four different formulations of the same molecule. This is the usual structural formula which tells you how many carbon atoms are in the molecule and what substituents there are present. But these models here, which chemists now prefer by far to use, tell you what these molecules look in three-dimensional space. You see, for example, that the same molecule has a number of extensions at this underside here, and it turns out from another model which shows you the space that this molecule occupies, that this is a rather sandwich-like molecule, or at least part of it, namely this part here. It has two planes. The molecule is flat, above and below. And this turns out to be one of the secrets of cholesterol, that in three-dimensional space, part of it looks like a sandwich. Now, the reason why I said this molecule was an invention after life began is that its formation requires oxygen. As extensive studies have shown, the formation of cholesterol in cells requires the intervention of molecular oxygen at various stages. And no alternative conditions can be found to construct this molecule in the absence of oxygen, for example, under the so-called primitive earth conditions. So we postulate that photosynthesis must have existed to produce oxygen before this molecule could be formed. In other words, it was a latecomer in evolution. Now, what I will focus on are some of these events which occur between the formation of the first structure, which has four rings, three of which are six-membered and one is five-membered, and the subsequent modification of this molecule, which involve essentially a fine-tuning or a trimming or pruning of this structure here, which is called the nostril. This structure, number 3, has 3 more carbon atoms than cholesterol in the form of so-called methyl groups. And these methyl groups are sequentially removed, first here, and then one of these here, and then the second, the third one. And these trimming operations, modifying operations, occur in a definite sequence, invariant in all cells which produce cholesterol. Now, what is the rationale for the removal of these methyl groups, and why does it occur invariably in the same order? Well, the reason why these methyl groups are undesirable is because they're not compatible with the 2 planar surfaces in the sterol structure which I've just mentioned. Here you have again the cholesterol structure with 2 planes above and below, but in the precursor which precedes this molecule in biological systems, you have these methyl groups sticking out. They protrude from what would otherwise be a plane. They're like knobs on a flat surface. And these knobs have to be removed. And we will see in a moment why they have to be removed. Well, if you build a model of a so-called membrane. Now, membranes are envelopes of cells. Cells have an aqueous content. In order for these contents to be confined inside the cell, you need a shield or an envelope to keep all the metabolites keep them from leaking out. And this shell, this envelope, is constructed from molecules which include cholesterol, which is shown again here, and so-called phospholipids, which have long paraffin-like chains. And these 2 partners in the cell membrane interact. They make contact, they make numerous contacts because they are compatible with each other. You can bring them close to each other. And therefore, by interacting with this molecule here, the fatty acyl chain, the cholesterol structure makes this cell membrane more solid. In a way, it creates order out of chaos. In the absence of the cholesterol structure, these molecules would be wiggly. And by being wiggly, they would make the cell membrane very fluid. But by providing this partner, this surface here, which is compatible with that of the paraffinic chains, an interaction takes place, and you convert an essentially liquid phase to a solid phase, and that seems to be important for membrane function. It is clear that when... now let's go back. As we saw a moment ago, that these knobs, as I call them, have to be removed in order to make the functionally competent molecule. This molecule, we predicted, would be unsuitable to function in membranes because of these protruding extra carbon atoms, and therefore they had to be removed in a certain sequence. Now, so far, all I've told you about cholesterol and its late stages in its formation is pure speculation and what the chemist calls model building. He puts these carbons next to each other and looks at the shape and the dimension of the molecule in 3-dimensional space. And this is like playing with Tinker Toys, but considerably more instructive. Speculations in science are all right, but no one takes them seriously unless you provide experimental proof so that others can repeat the experiment. And we were fortunate enough to find some conditions where we could show that what we had postulated could in fact be reproduced, at least in a so-called model membrane. you make a model membrane, and then you insert into this model membrane the compounds which you're interested in, namely cholesterol on the one hand and lanosterol on the other. And the curves you see here are a measure of the competence of the molecule to exercise a membrane function, a desirable membrane function. And you see that cholesterol is very good at it. It raises the so-called viscosity. It does make the membrane more solid. And the more cholesterol is put into this membrane, the more solid it becomes. Now, the precursor of this molecule, which has three more methyl groups, is totally incompetent under these conditions. But if you remove now, one by one, these knobs, and the cells do it one by one, you see that eventually, when you reach cholesterol, you have reached perfection. You have converted an incompetent molecule into a competent one simply by removing three carbon atoms. Well, these are model membranes, and they are usually a good guide, but what nature does under the same molecules, you have to prove. And we were fortunate enough to work with a very small bacterium called Mycoplasma capricolum, because it likes tissues of the goat as a habitat. And this has a requirement for cholesterol. Cholesterol is a vitamin for this organism, as it were. So you can test it, the competence of these various compounds by measuring the rate of growth of this bacterium. The bacterium will grow at fastest with cholesterol, which is its normal vitamin. But the inadequate molecule, this one here, you see, allows these cells to grow only very, very slowly. But as you remove methyl groups, as we have done here, one by one, you find that the properties of the molecule improve, and ultimately you reach both in the model membrane and in real life a structure which seems to have been perfected by discrete evolutionary studies. Now, one problem in evolution, organismic or chemical, is the lack of the fossil record. This is what most evolutionists complain about. We have very few intermediary stages between the chimpanzee and man, which is nevertheless in a relationship which we nevertheless believe exists on the basis of genetic evidence, on the basis of morphological, anatomical evidence, and so forth. And similarly, in my speculations, I have found very few, but sufficient fossil organisms, I would like to call them, which support the hypothesis that the cholesterol molecule evolved in time and wasn't created all at once. We find cholesterol in all so-called eukaryotes. These are higher cells, plant cells and animal cells. You find the very early precursor, hydrocarbon squalene, which has the same number of carbon atoms, in the most primitive bacteria, including the so-called archaebacteria, a recently discovered new kingdom of living cells, and which are assumed to be the most primitive ones extant. You do, however, find a compound in which one of these methyl groups is missing in an aerobic bacterium. They're interestingly a bacterium which will grow only on methane as a carbon source. And then you find another microorganism or unicellular organism, a flagellate, a dinoflagellate, dinosterol, which contains only one of these methyl groups. So we have two examples, two fossils, which occurred or arose at different times, which recapitulate, as it were, the modern biosynthetic pathway. So we do have evidence that each successive product in the pathway is functionally superior to its predecessor. And this is the gist of my hypothesis. Now, on close inspection of the cholesterol structure, that is not made as clear here, unfortunately, but you will have noted that there are other methyl groups in the molecule which apparently are not touched, which are left in place. And the methyl groups which are involved in the streamlining process I've talked about are all on the same or underside of the molecule, namely here and here and here. But the methyl groups above are not. They always remain in place, or almost always. Why is that so? Why the selectivity? It's in a selective enzymatic attack on a structure, and since it is selective and not random, it must have functional significance. Now, I'll show you why nature has not continued this process of cutting out, excising these knobs. There is a compound, you see the structure in the next slide, which has one methyl group less than cholesterol, called 90-norcholesterol, and if you examine it the same way as we have examined the earlier compounds, you see, when you go from cholesterol now to this 19-nor compound, which contains one less methyl group, still one less methyl group than its precursor, you see that the functional competence now drops very sharply. It would appear that one has gone too far in the streamlining process, and one has gone over the hill, as it were, and this step was not advantageous because it resulted in a lowered ability to make the membrane viscous. And now this compound is formed, unfortunately, or to my dismay, I discovered that this compound in question, this is one you saw on the previous slide, to be less competent than cholesterol, rather than more competent, to my dismay, certain marine invertebrates, namely the gorgonians and sponges, carry out this reaction. Well, this would seem to be a very powerful argument against my generalized hypothesis that these modifying steps, which take groups away because they interfere. However, one can make the following argument. There is a dilemma, I admit, but one can get out of it. Or there is an escape hatch. One very distinguished biologist, François Jacob, has given much wise thought to modern evolutionary theory, views many of innovations adapted by nature as a result of what he calls tinkering as opposed to engineering. The engineer proceeds by executing a carefully drawn plan. He follows a design. The tinkerer achieves results, failures as well as successes by trial and error. Perhaps what gorgonian and sponges do with the sterol structure is a case of unsuccessful molecular tinkering. Other organisms did not follow the example because it did not confer selective advantage. It appears, moreover, that gorgonians and sponges were not especially successful in the evolutionary struggle. They have survived, but they did not evolve further. They lie on a dead-end branch of the evolutionary tree. Well, this is my way of getting out of the dilemma and trying to maintain the generality of my hypothesis. So let me summarize by repeating my main argument. As the term implies, evolution is a gradual temporal process, not only at the level of the gene, but at the lower pre-Darwinian level of small molecules as well. In the examples I've given, each of the molecular modification, each invention leads to improvement of function. This took time. How much time we do not know, but certainly more than Genesis or creationism would allow. Perhaps I've been able to convince you that the cholesterol molecule, unlike Pallas Athena, did not spring fully blown from the head of Zeus, nor, like the hydras, emerged fully formed from a clamshell. I'm sorry that this reproduction, since you all know it anyhow, it doesn't matter. The descent of man from primordial slime, amoeba, or even the chimpanzee have yet to inspire similar artistic creativity. Odes to Darwin remain to be written, the equivalent of Haydn's creation to be composed. But perhaps there is hope. Here is an example, admittedly an attempt, perhaps a feeble one, Salvador Dali portraying the DNA molecule biblically in the form of a Jacob's ladder. Finally, let me quote a prophetical statement from the distant past made by none other than Aristotle. Nature is the end, and what each thing is when fully developed, we call nature. Thank you.
I'm almost afraid to ask her questions. We have, I think, an overflow audience in the other room. We may have to go into the other room to see the other part of the audience. I'll wait for our runner to come back. If there are not too many, he's going to ask them to move into this room. We can take a question while we're waiting. Yes? If there was no sugar whatsoever, could cholesterol exist?
Yes, but you need an alternative source of carbon. For example, the smallest precursor which can be shown to go specifically into cholesterol is acetic acid. Now, you need a source of this acetic acid, and in all forms of life, the source of this acetic acid is sugar, glucose. So glucose is really the ultimate carbon source for all metabolic transformation, for energy production, for syntheses in biological systems. And this can be shown very readily if you take an organism like yeast or Escherichia coli. All you have to add to the growth medium is glucose and ammonia, and that is all, an ammonium salt. In other words, every organism which can make the sterol molecule can make it from glucose, and some can also make it from acetic acid. But then you have to provide a source for forming this acetic acid, so eventually you always come back to glucose.
Yes?
Since you began with biology and ended with philosophy, I'd like to ask the question which marries the two. Can I say that Auschwitz were peculiar chemical problems, that my own moral reaction to Auschwitz is nothing more than, say, my own peculiar chemical problem? Or must I wait for the evening when I can conveniently forget chemistry to discuss the other problem?
I'm sorry, I
don't think
could
that,
you repeat the gist of your question?
I don't think that's a fair question, and I'll exercise the prerogative of the chair and disallow it. Do we have another question? How did we have water?
No. You see,
oxygen?
Oxygen in the form of water existed from the time that the Earth cooled down. You see, the chemist calls it dioxygen. Two oxygen atoms combined. This is what we call molecular oxygen. This is the oxygen we breathe, right? In the form of water, it's not oxidizing. Only in the form of gaseous oxygen is it oxidizing.
Could you repeat the question after she asked?
Yes.
The other part of my question is, you seem to indicate not be a possibility of recreation of life on this planet?
The question is, did I indicate that after nuclear war there would be no possibility of life on this planet? What I stated has no relation whatsoever to any catastrophic events. All I'm saying is that today, regardless of conditions, foreseeable natural conditions, life could not start again, because life could start only in the absence of oxygen, and we have no way of removing oxygen from the atmosphere and watching life to evolve, as it were. So it is a very essential argument throughout for life to begin that oxygen was not present. And this is a chemical argument, essentially, survival of molecules. We all know if we put organic molecules in the form of meat or whatever, either in a refrigerator, in a deep freeze, and the lower the temperature, of course, the lower the rate of spoilage or oxidation. But ultimately, even under these conditions, organic molecules will decay, provided you, unless you surround it with an atmosphere of nitrogen or remove oxygen from it.
In the back? Against the wall.
In our own solar system, the moons of Saturn and Jupiter are considered to have the highest chances of finding some sort of primitive chemicals necessary for life. Could you speculate on that in the solar system and elsewhere in the universe?
Yeah. The question is a cosmological one, if I may tell this to the general audience. It has to do what, where, or are the conditions of life or favorable for life if, on other planets. I can only give you the answers and say I do not know. If anybody knows, there's maybe someone in the audience, I think some planets have been identified where life is possible. Mars at one time was a candidate. But I would like to limit my comments to the field I know reasonably well, which is chemistry and biological chemistry.
Yes?
Along the lines of your speculation, how do you explain the transition from organic molecules to life and to
yes. You remember, the question is, how do you explain the change from small molecules to what are known as macromolecules? That is, very large molecules such as DNA or protein. Well, this is one of the $64,000 questions. And there are some reasonably successful attempts to put nucleic acid bases together, again, under the so-called primitive Earth conditions. And you can make chains up to perhaps 10 or 15 so-called oligonucleotides under chemical conditions with some degree of specificity. But the problem is not so much to make a large polymer per se, but to have the correct order of the purine and pyrimidine bases so you get a genetic code which is not a nonsense code, okay? Does that answer your question? Well, then what you want to know is not known.
Yes?
Along exactly the same lines, if you don't mind, do you see a continual transition between chemical evolution and the biological evolution? Is that a continual transition, or is there a sudden nucleation event which may have been a very rare event to get a bushfire started?
Well, the answer is the transition from the non-biological to the biological world, a continuing event or a sudden one. Now, I'm not sure whether you have in mind the so-called panspermia hypothesis. But perhaps I ought to mention a very interesting
speculation which totally avoids and evades the problem we are facing, but which is very intriguing. In 1880, a Swedish chemist, Svante Arrhenius, well known to all chemists, postulated that life arrived on this planet from outer space. I have been unable to find out why he thought this was a likely event. But this speculation has been publicized and, in fact, is promoted, is not the right word, but defended by the very distinguished scientist Francis Crick, and he has written a book called Life Itself, which elaborates the panspermia theory. Panspermia means seeding of the planet Earth from outer space. And the specific model which Crick develops is a spaceship arriving from some planet far away, carrying certain microorganisms which are already far along in evolution and falling on fertile ground in the ocean, in the Earth ocean, and then developing very rapidly because the main problems of evolution have already been solved. Well, I mean, the real problem is really what happened before life began, and to postulate that some non-sentient beings were sent by some highly developed culture with a highly developed space technology to this planet is simply evading the issue. But there is one of the, I think, valid arguments of Arrhenius, and particularly Crick, is that since the Big Bang supposedly occurred upward of 10 billion years ago, and since the Earth is only 4.5 billion years old, you have a number of billion of years to play with. And if some planet cooled down or was formed before the solar system did, let us say 8 billion years ago, a civilization evolving on this planet X might have been sufficiently advanced then to seed the planet Earth.
I'll then, before I call on Dean Weber to thank our guest, I'll remind all of you that Professor George Neal Towers of the Department of Botany will speak next week on medical botany in the environmental challenge. You will know that Dr. Towers is internationally known for his research into the chemistry of plants and has agreed to speak to us on the 24th of March next on this important subject. May I ask Dr. Weber to come forward and to thank our guest speaker. Professor Block, you can stay here.
Well, thank you, Mr. Vogel. It's indeed a pleasure on behalf of this audience to have an opportunity to thank Dr. Block for his very eloquent presentation this evening. I would like to make two comments, one general and one personal. The general one is that we tend to think of scientists today as being individuals focused increasingly narrowly on highly specialized areas of their particular interest. And I think it has been most fascinating this evening to hear such a scientist, but to recognize his capability to put sophisticated knowledge into a very broad context indeed. Secondly, referring back to the introduction, and as a dean of medicine, I would like to say that as far as I can determine, at least in the last 40 or 50 years, there has been relatively little evolution in the behavior of deans of medicine. They continue as devious as the dean at Yale. I would, however, like to think that some of the numerous letters which I write, that any one of them could have as profound effect on the development and future of science as my predecessor who wrote to Dr. Block many years ago.
On behalf of the Institute, I thank you and adjourn this meeting.